Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, Monsignor Philip Whitmore brings us a musical meditation for the first Sunday in Advent. The second in Dominican Father Paul Murray's series by the title of The Task of Happiness of Human Suffering and Christian Joy. And celebrating a significant milestone in the history of English and Welsh Catholicism. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. Throughout 2012, the Venerable English College here in Rome has been celebrating a significant milestone in the history of English and Welsh Catholicism. 6 centuries and a half since the founding of an English and Welsh hospice on this very site. Founded in 1362, it's the oldest English institution outside of England, although the English presence in Rome precedes this by some 5 centuries with the presence of the Scola Saxonum alongside the Vatican Hill in the 8th century. However, with the split between Rome and Elizabeth I, it no longer became possible to train priests at home, and so the hospice became a seminary to prepare young men for the mission to England and Wales. On Saturday 1st of December, some 120 people are expected to celebrate Mass on Martyrs' Day at the college, among them Archbishop Nichols of Westminster, who will be principal celebrant. Presiding in choir will be his predecessor, the Archbishop Emeritus of Westminster, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, rector of the Venerabili, as it's called here, from 1971 to 1977. Other bishops are expected to concelebrate. They're coming from England and Wales and, of course, from the Vatican. On this same day, the college will be honoured by the presence of their Royal Highnesses, the Duke and Duchess of Gloucester, representing Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II at this celebration marking the close of the anniversary year. A reminder of the significant contribution made by the hospice to the British heritage over several centuries, and in particular of the royal patronage enjoyed by this house in Tudor times. A more Vatican-related event will take place on Monday, 3rd of December, when bishops, staff and students of the college will cross the Tiber River and make their way to the Apostolic Palace in the Vatican. There they'll be received in private audience by Pope Benedict XVI. In an effort to find out more about this special anniversary, I spoke to the rector of the Venerable English College. He's Monsignor Nicholas Hudson. But why don't you stay tuned? Six centuries and a half since the foundation deed which established an English and Welsh hospice on this site. Am I right in saying its foundation in 1362 made it the first ever English institution abroad?
There's no doubt that there is no English institution outside of England that goes back further than this one. And what is striking is that we've been on this site since 1362 and a little bit before, because it was about 4 years prior to the foundation deed in 1362 that John and Alice Shepherd bought a house on this site, and were persuaded 4 years later by the Confraternity of St. Thomas of Canterbury, which had been set up to welcome pilgrims to Rome from England and Wales. They were persuaded to sell their house to the Confraternity to become the hospice. So, yes, we've been here for 650 years plus.
By the word hospice, what does one intend? A house to welcome the weary and sometimes sick pilgrims who came to Rome on foot?
Yes, the word hospice is a little bit confusing for us in England and Wales and in Britain, because we think of it as a place where there is given palliative care. So I invariably say to pilgrims who come here and whom I'm showing around the college that these days we would call it a hostel. But your question is a good one, because there is a stress in the statutes for the foundation of the hospice that particular care, as it says, should be given to welcome the infirm and the needy as well as the poor. So clearly part of the ethos of the place from the outset was that the infirm and the weak and the sickly would be as welcome as anybody else here.
When you say anybody else, it was a popular place. Now Henry VIII apparently referred to it as our hospice. You had some famous guests here, didn't you?
Yes, there have been some famous guests. It seems that from the outset, the hospice was much in demand and was quite a success. From the little house that began roughly where you have the main entrance to the church on Via Monserrato now, very soon the income accruing from the number of pilgrims coming to stay was such that the confraternity were able to buy up houses to left and right, going along Via Monserrato, stretching right up to the Swedish hospice, which had been established by St. Bridget of Sweden next door, and soon became really quite a large institution. So yes, a lot of pilgrims began to come quickly, and there were some famous ones who've passed through its doors over the centuries, not least a man who became a notorious priest hunter, Thomas Cromwell, but future saints too. St. Henry Walpole, when he was thinking about the priesthood, came to stay here. And then when the hospice was well established, the poet John Milton came too.
Two centuries later, another date linked to this house and two events in England marked the second milestone for you here at the college. It was 1579, and the hospice became what it is today, a seminary for English and Welsh Catholic young men.
That's right. Just as 1350 was a crucial date for understanding why the hospice began, so 1570 was a crucial date for understanding why the hospice became a seminary. I put it that way because 1350 was a holy year when a great number of pilgrims came from England and Wales and other parts of Europe to Rome at the Pope's invitation and encouragement. And many of them found that they weren't properly catered for. They couldn't find places to stay in Rome. So it was at the confraternity decided to set up a hospice. Come 1570, when Queen Elizabeth I of England was excommunicated, very quickly it became prohibited in England and Wales to train men for the Catholic priesthood. So the continuing Catholic community had to look abroad to train future priests. And they first began to train men just over the water from Dover in Douai, or Douai, as we call it, which was in Flanders then and is now in France. And it is remarkable and edifying that so many young men offered themselves for the priesthood in spite of the fact that they knew that they risked being arrested, imprisoned, possibly tortured, and even executed. They still came forward in such numbers that Douai became full. And so the man who was responsible for the training of future priests, Cardinal William Allen, had the inspired idea, a very significant idea for this house, of in fact transforming the hospice into a second English college. And so it was that in 1579, the first students came from Douai for this to become a seminary in its own right.
One of the reasons the college is referred to as venerable is partly because the relics of martyrs are venerated here in the Martyrs' Chapel. Do you think the legacy of witness, which is a spiritual one, lingers on here after all these centuries?
I do think that the martyrs are very present to us, as I like to think we're present to them. On the first day that students come to the college, I take them into the college church and show them the martyrs' picture, which is the altarpiece painted by Durante Alberti, which was put in place in the old hospice church to adorn the new seminary chapel, and very quickly became known as the martyr's picture. And the reason for that is that in the first century of the college's existence, between 1581 and 1678, 44 of the students from this house were martyred by being hanged, drawn, quartered. And Whenever they heard that one of their brothers had been executed in that way, then all the students with their superiors would come into the college church and sing a Te Deum Laudamus in front of that painting. And for that reason, it soon became known as the martyr's picture. So yes, the memory of the martyrs is very much alive. And I always say to the students on the first day that they're here that I'm sure that the martyrs pray for each of them every day of their time here in seminary, and that we must pray to the martyrs to intercede for us.
And a big thank you there to the rector of the Venerable English College here in Rome, Monsignor Nicholas Hudson, for sharing with us this information. Meanwhile, without leaving the premises of the Venerable English College, our historian brings us a sound picture of graphic decorations of martyrdom within this same church, in the raised gallery there, which brings home the heroism of the Catholic priest who trained here, knowing all the while what he would face upon his return home. But why don't you join me there with my historian, Stella Fletcher?
Well, we're now in the gallery of the English College. Down below is the chapel, but we're now upstairs and we're surrounded by the most gruesome-looking paintings. What have we got there? There's somebody being burnt and then somebody hanging above them. Oh, there, that one's having his innards taken out. Oh, he's about to be beheaded. It's all pretty gruesome. Now, what's the point of all this? These were painted in the 16th century, and they depict the fate awaiting the young Englishmen who are here in Rome training to be Catholic priests, and they're going to be sent back to the England of Elizabeth I. And the message of these paintings is, this is what you're going back to. You are going to be martyred. Basically, it's a very, very tense atmosphere. This is the message that is coming out of Rome. The message that's coming out of England is that the papists are all things diabolical and bad. So it's a war of words and a war of actions on both sides. The papacy excommunicates Elizabeth I, and so on and so forth. Perhaps you've seen the film Elizabeth, and perhaps that takes it a little too far, but you get the right idea. It's all lots of suspicion, intrigue, and espionage. Now, into the middle of all this, in the year 1579, came a young man called Anthony Munday. He was, I think, only in his teens, late teens, when he decided to have an adventure and come to Rome with a friend of his. They travelled overland across Europe and said, oh yes, we're going to Rome. And they went to all the English communities dotted around the Low Countries and in France and received lots of help from these people. These were the English Catholic exiles, and they helped them get to Rome. And when they came to Rome, naturally, they fell in with their fellow Englishmen. They came here to the English College. First of all, they were accepted as pilgrims. As pilgrims, they were allowed to stay for 8 days. Didn't matter who they were. After that period of time was up, these two young men were taken into the college and somehow accepted as students. They were, in the terms used at the time, grammarians. He sort of claimed they were vaguely interested in becoming priests, but not many people were terribly convinced by that. Anthony Munday and his friend were only here for a few months. But during that time, there was one of the most dramatic episodes in the entire history of the English College, when the students rebelled against the rector. Sure, the rector today is a very nice man, and the students wouldn't dream of rebelling against him. But in the late 16th century, there was a particular problem with a particular rector. His name was Morris Clinnock, but in Anthony Munday's version, he appears as Dr. Morris. Now, that name, Morris Clinnock, it is not English. It is Welsh. And herein lay the problem. The students were English, and they rebelled against their Welsh rector, particularly when the rector wanted to give a room to a young Welshman who needed lots of support and encouragement, perhaps a relative of his, you never know. And Anthony Munday was turfed out of his room so that the Welshman could have it. So all the English students banded together, and they protested first to the cardinal, who was the protector of this institution, and then they protested to the Pope. And eventually the Pope gave them their way, and they said, yes, I'll depose the rector, if you like, and give you what you want, which was government by the Jesuits. They were taught by the Jesuits, and they said, we want them to lead our college. What actually happened was a compromise. Now, how very English that is, to compromise. Now, the institution was separated into two parts, so that there was the hospice for the pilgrims, and Dr. Morris remained in charge of that, but the education of the students was put in the hands of the Jesuits.
You were listening there to historian Stella Fletcher. And now, moving on in the broadcast, time to go musical. That's with our music historian, Monsignor Philip Whitmore, who brings us this meditation focusing on the first Sunday in Advent.
A generation or two ago, a very unpopular job among seminary students was ringing the bell first thing in the morning to get everyone out of bed. The reason it was unpopular, of course, was that it meant getting up even earlier, so as to be ready on time. At the start of Advent, we hear again and again the call to wake up, to get ready, to prepare ourselves for the day that is dawning. We all know how hard that can be if we're feeling sleepy. But we all know how necessary it is if we have something important to do. What could be more important than being ready to greet our Saviour when he comes? Wachet auf, ruft uns die Stimme. Awake, a voice is calling. That's the title of an old German hymn for Advent. The version we just heard was arranged by Michael Praetorius early in the 17th century, but probably more familiar to modern listeners is the arrangement made by J.S. Bach 100 years later. If any of you have worked with church choirs or liturgy planning groups, you'll know how hard it can be to prepare the music Sunday after Sunday for public worship. Imagine what it would be like if you had to compose the music as well. But that's exactly what J.S. Bach did for most of his life. He wrote his cantatas for use during the Sunday liturgy in Weimar and in Leipzig, often producing a new one each week. The cantata he wrote for the last Sunday of November in 1731 was Wachet auf, and he based a lot of the music on the tune we've been listening to. Now, I bet some of you are thinking, yes, it's lovely music, but it doesn't sound much like the tune we heard before. Wait for it. Bach is setting the scene with a beautiful counter melody, preparing the way for the coming of the tune. Here it is, in long, slow notes in the voice parts. Thank you. Listen now to a passage a bit later on, where Bach sets the second verse. Zion hears the watchman singing. That's the counter melody. Now for the tune. Many people find the spiritual quality of Bach's music a great help with their prayer. It can settle us into a recollected frame of mind. If you get the chance, you may like to listen to a recording of Bach's cantata Wachet auf as part of your Advent devotion. At the heart of it is a dialogue between Christ and the soul. When the heavenly bridegroom comes, he invites the soul to join him at the wedding feast. No eye has ever seen, no ear has ever heard such joy as this.
And you were listening there to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. Finally, I'm about to bring you part three in Dominican preacher and poet Father Paul Murray's series focusing on human suffering and Christian joy by the title of The Task of Happiness. In the previous episode, Father Paul introduced us to Kevin, a prisoner on death row, whose dramatic story provided us with a mysterious witness to Christian joy. Father Paul now goes a step further, taking a closer look at one of the reasons he feels occasioned this breakthrough from suffering to joy, the experience of prayer.
I think it is of great significance that when in his letter Kevin, the young prisoner on death row, speaks about prayer, he also speaks about desire.
Something is drawing my desire towards the joys of heaven. It seems that the moment I start to pray, I'm directly in touch with God, or I feel that I must give my heart just that one jump of desire into eternity.
Prayer, like nothing else in our lives, brings us down to the root of our desire. We discover, in prayer, new things about God, but also new things about ourselves. And the most notable, and the most surprising, perhaps, is the buried strength of our desire, the almost intolerable ache at the core of each one of us, what C.S. Lewis calls, in an astonishing phrase, our inconsolable secret. In prayer, we begin to realize that God has made our hearts so deep, our love so mysterious, that nothing apart from God will ever fully satisfy us or bring us lasting joy. This realization has not only been experienced, it also has been described by Christian men and women over the centuries, and often with great vividness. Even St. Thomas Aquinas, a theologian normally noted for his calmness and restraint, exclaims in his treatise on the love of God and neighbor,
God excels every desirable thing. He rejoices the heart in a more intimate and more lasting manner than all delightful things.
Of course, in Aquinas' opinion, there are many things which in themselves are good, things which God wants us to enjoy. But compared to God, St. Thomas points out,
other things afford us pleasure in a superficial manner, as if exteriorly, but God delights us intimately, and therefore profoundly.
Aquinas then goes on to conclude, and the statement is memorable.
God alone substantially penetrates the very substance of the soul, and consequently rejoices the marrow of our bones.
Today, we find ourselves surrounded on all sides by people of different religions or none, speaking to us about spirituality or about the search for meaning. But how seldom we read or hear anything about God that approaches the stark simplicity and passion of Aquinas' statement. Why this is so is not at all easy to explain. But I would like to consider at least one factor in the situation. Since the early 20th century and the advent of modern depth psychology, it has been commonplace to speak about the repression of sexual desire. But perhaps there is today a more fundamental repression at work in our society, and not only in what we call secular society, but also, and strange to say, in some of the new groups and quasi-religious movements which have emerged recently, and whose members take an active interest in spirituality. For that interest almost never seems to extend to an admission of the true depth of our desire for God, or indeed, of God's desire for us. As if such an admission in itself would somehow subvert the control we want to exercise over both our secular and our spiritual lives. But with the grace of prayer and the humility and strength which that grace brings, we find courage to go down to the root of our desire. We begin to trust and to surrender all that we have and all that we are to God. And in doing so, in surrendering to the mystery, we begin at last to experience in faith something of that passion of joy, that great delight in knowing God of which Aquinas speaks.
And our thanks there go to Dominican preacher and poet Father Paul Murray. And that brings me up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, I'll be back again at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join me then. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is rv.va, and then click on the English World icon. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.